The new Great Space Observatories, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Four magnificent telescopes, four magnificent teams behind them, each representing years of work and dreams of science beyond anything yet accomplished. Now, even as they are pitted against each other for ranking in the Astro 2020 Decadal Survey, these teams have come together in a coalition called the New Great Observatories. Astrophysicist Grant Tremblay hopes all will be recognized as the complementary tools that could work together to answer those greatest of questions: where do we come from, and are we alone? Grant will join us right after we take a look at the downlink, and just before we welcome back Bruce Betts for another edition of What's Up. We can congratulate China yet again. Its Zhurong rover has rolled down onto the surface of Mars, so there are now three mobile robots exploring the surface of the red planet, with the InSight lander continuing to peer beneath that surface. You can check out our coverage at planetary.org/downlink. Nearly 300 white papers were submitted to the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine as part of the 2020 Astronomy and Astrophysics Decadal Survey. There are proposals for research and instruments ranging from the relatively inexpensive to what used to be called flagships, projects that will each cost billions and take many years to fulfill. There are four of these major projects, and Grant Tremblay loves all of them. Grant works at the Harvard and Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and is most closely associated with the proposal for LINX, an amazing X-ray telescope that would be orders of magnitude more powerful than the Chandra instrument that has been in space since 1999. But Grant is also part of a grand coalition that unites all four proposals and teams. I had to make a thankless choice as I assembled this week's show. I could either include Grant's admiring descriptions of all four telescopes, or let him share the story behind this coalition. I decided on the latter, but I hope you'll listen to our complete conversation at planetary.org/radio, where Grant describes each in detail. You've already heard about LINX. HABEX is the Habitable Exoplanets Observatory. It would fly in tandem with a giant star shade that could block the light of a star to reveal possible worlds teeming with life orbiting it. LUVOIR is the Large Ultraviolet Optical Infrared Surveyor. It, too, could reveal details of exoplanets. It looks like a giant version of the James Webb Space Telescope. And the Origin Space Telescope would be supercooled to just above absolute zero so that it could observe weak sources of infrared light, including Earth-like planets. Grant, welcome to Planetary Radio. You spent some time at the Space Telescope Science Institute, right?
I did about half my PhD at the Space Telescope Science Institute, the operational heart of the Hubble Space Telescope. My office was actually in the former Hubble control room, which later moved to the Goddard Space Flight Center. But yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's exciting. Now, of course, among other things, you are involved with one of the four projects, or deeply involved with one of the four projects that we're going to be talking about. Although we are going to talk about all four of them, because you have put your energy behind marketing. And that, I'm sorry to say, is the word, but it's a necessary word for what's going on right now. Because, as we have heard from many others on this show, we are in the midst of a new decadal survey. Not the Planetary Science Decadal Survey, right? But a different one. And these four telescopes that make up what you are calling the New Great Observatories, and we'll explain why new in a moment for anybody who doesn't know about the old ones, no offense meant. Why is this happening right now as part of the Decadal Survey?
Yeah, so every 10 years on the decade, the National Academy of Science runs the so-called Decadal Survey in order to build and fly these great observatories, these multi-billion dollar, multi-decade, generational flagships that really push outward on the edges of human understanding. In order to get the money and the constituency and the drive to build them, you need the top recommendation of the Decadal Survey. So as your listeners probably know, there are multiple Decadal Surveys. Astronomy was one of the first. Since 1960, there's been a Decadal Survey. And it is the top recommendation from that survey that gives life to the generational flagships of space astrophysics to come. So the Hubble Space Telescope came out of the 1970 Decadal Survey. Chandra was the top recommendation of the 1980 Decadal Survey. Spitzer, 1990. JWST, 2000. Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, 2010. And here we are in 2020.
Quite a process. And NASA pays close attention to the recommendations of the Decadal Survey, doesn't it?
They are obligated to pay attention. It's literally hard-coded into law. Section 805, public law of the NASA Authorization Act of 2010, for example, literally requires NASA to follow the recommendation of the Decadal Survey to the best of their ability, of course. But absolutely, NASA is obligated to follow the Decadal.
By and large, it has proven to be a pretty good practice, right? Because, I mean, we have now this being steered, not that politics don't ever enter into it, but largely driven by the scientists who want to answer these great questions.
Absolutely. Look, ultimately, these are engines of science. They're platforms of discovery. Their design, their so-called level one science requirements, or the questions that they are built to pursue, are defined by the scientific community, right? They're designed to pursue the most urgent astrophysical questions before us. These aren't niche science experiments. These astrophysical questions are literally like, are we alone? How does the universe work? How did we get here? They're the biggest questions before our species and the life that covers our little rock in the void. I love that the Decadal Survey effectively puts the science first, and it is the science that drives the requirements and therefore the mission design.
And there are some pretty fierce competitions that frequently surface during the Decadal Surveys, all of the Decadal Surveys. And as we have said on this show, so many worthy proposals and only a few that will receive the enormous amount of funding that it's going to take to make them a reality. You've already mentioned the great observatories that have done their work, a couple of them still doing that work, just taking them in order of electromagnetic wavelength. Spitzer, starting at the bottom with infrared. Hubble, a little bit of infrared, but largely optical. Chandra, X-ray, and topping it out, Compton. Cosmic energy. And I mentioned that, cosmic rays. I mentioned that because we're looking, in a sense, at kind of the same spread across the spectrum with what you are calling, as we said, the new great observatories. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, the Great Observatories program began in the mid-80s after a conversation between the head of NASA astrophysics at the time, Charlie Pellerin, and someone named George Field, who actually ran the 1980 Decadal. It began as a branding exercise. You know, in the late 80s, the economy was in the tank thanks to the savings and loan crisis in the US. We had just suffered an immense human and national tragedy, the Challenger disaster. The Hubble Space Telescope was massively behind schedule, massively over budget, and following the Challenger tragedy was without a launch vehicle. We still had grand plans, right? And so it began as a branding exercise in order to effectively market this constellation of space-borne observatories, literally in DC on the Hill, right? A brochure was drawn up. They hired a great cartoonist. But that thing wasn't meant for the public. That was meant for congresspeople and their staffers. And it turns out, here we are now 3 decades later, and Great Observatories is no longer just, you know, a piece of programmatic branding for 4 missions launched between 1990 and 2003. Great Observatory means a powerful, flexible, long-lived discovery platform that is flexible enough to pursue questions we literally haven't even thought of asking yet, right? Mm. When the Hubble Space Telescope launched, we didn't know for sure that exoplanets existed. And now some of the top-level Hubble science comes from exoplanet observations. One of the level one science requirements for the Hubble was to measure the deceleration parameter of the universe.
Right? I was hoping you'd get to this.
The deceleration parameter, right? And Hubble later found out, won the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, that we had the sign wrong, right? That it's an acceleration parameter of the universe. Yeah, great observatories, it's not just branding anymore. It's a vision for these incredibly powerful platforms of discovery. So that means that the great observatories aren't just those four missions, Hubble, Compton, Chandra, and Spitzer. It also applies to the James Webb Space Telescope and the soon-to-come Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. But it also applies to these four profound visions for discovery that are currently under competition at the Decadal Survey now.
I think of these as investments with a good return on investment. And I also think of them, since it's a big word nowadays in Washington and elsewhere, as infrastructure. That might be a stretch for some people in Congress, maybe even for the administration, but I wonder if you agree with me in any sense.
Oof, I'm bullish, Matt. I don't even think it's a stretch. This is shovel-ready infrastructure of the highest order, right? It is infrastructure of discovery. It checks all of the jingoistic boxes on the hill. American-made tech, right? Intellectual leadership. I find the comparisons really uncomfortable, but for a lot of our colleagues on the Hill, it goes a long way that China can't build a JWST, and it hits at all this Cold War-esque space racy stuff that I think is largely unhelpful, but does carry a lot of water on the Hill. Look, I view these things as profoundly, profoundly worthy and frankly cheap or kind of a great deal investments in everything from soft power, right? Nations spend billions of dollars on soft power around the world. And the great observatories, something that is not designed to hurt anybody, something that's designed only to push outward on the edges of human understanding, is a fantastic investment in global soft power. Because that's real power that has the power to inspire a kid to get into space, to pursue their curiosity. Yeah, look, these things are not cheap, but they are phenomenal investments in discovery. And it absolutely is infrastructure. So that includes everything from the upcoming infrastructure reconciliation bill. Yeah, it's infrastructure.
Grant, I begin to understand why Heidi and others recommended you so highly as someone that I should speak to. Awareness of real politics while keeping your eyes on the stars, I think. These are inevitably international projects, right? Certainly the European Space Agency would have a deep interest in these.
Absolutely. These are global projects. These are observatories for everybody. Literally anyone around the world can write a proposal to use the Chandra X-ray Observatory right now. First of all, the Hubble is a NASA ESA observatory with an immense participation from the CSA. But astronomers and scientists all around the world use these observatories, design these observatories, work on these observatories. They're global projects.
Normally, I might provide the individual web addresses of each project on this week's episode page, planetary.org/radio, but you've made that much easier because you've collected this under the Great Observatories .org, and so we will definitely put that up on the page.
Let me just give you a little bit of context about why we're doing this. I'm in the leadership of the LINX X-ray Observatory team. I've dedicated years of my career, an enormous amount of blood, sweat, and tears, a lot of emotion, a lot of love for something that I've never been more proud of professionally, and that's the LINX final report. So you might think that when on August, I think it was August 18th or 19th of 2019, all of our final reports were submitted to NASA and became public, you might think that I immediately went to our so-called competitors and downloaded their reports and just read their reports with scorn or fury or we're better than them or some negative feeling. So I've read all four reports cover to cover. Well, you know, three competitors, and then I helped write substantial parts of our final report. The only thing that I took away with them is that these are just profound visions for discovery, right? Mm. I don't view them as competitors. They are four missions, but they really are one vision that absolutely carries the legacy of the great observatories forward. I want to do them all, literally. And so we created greatobservatories.org to try to manifest that, to give something to talk around, to move the Overton window from talking about how each of these projects is so expensive. Oh boy, what a lot of risk. What a lot of technology maturation that needs to happen to, let's just do them all. We've already done it. We did it in the 90s, right? yeah, these projects are more complex and more expensive, but so are the questions that we're asking about the universe. And so are the technologies that are required to pursue those questions.
Another thing that struck me as I looked at the four websites, all of which you can get to, as we said, from greatobservatories.org, I love to look at the people, the teams behind each one of these. They're big teams in all four cases, and they are all stars. It's just amazing to see how much of the astrophysics community, and for that matter, the planetary science community, is a part of at least one of each of these projects. It's an impressive commitment by all these people.
These missions are the culmination of decades of dreams from so many around the world, right? It's not just a mission concept that NASA decided to fund starting in 2015. These each have decades of history behind them. And that means it's not just mission trades and level one requirements. It's human pursuit. It's human stories, right? It's loss. I have no doubt that some of us, maybe all of us, will so-called, you know, quote-unquote, lose at the decadal, right? But that's not just a mission being shot down. That's dreams being deferred for another decade or another two decades.
When will we know the results of the 2020 Decadal Survey?
Yeah, so you and I are chatting on May 20th. I think this episode comes out next week, so May 26th,
yes,
or so, right? So that means we are almost exactly 1 month away from the release of the Decadal. I know that the Decadal, the top-level report, is in final stages of referee from some incredibly accomplished luminaries who have been chosen as referees for that very important document. And on the day the Decadal drops, the community, the astrophysics community around the world, will hold their collective breaths and watch their press conference and open that PDF on the National Academy's website and go to the executive summary and read the top recommendations for the large and medium and small ground and space-based projects. And we will know what the future of discovery looks like. Look, I want to make something clear before we hang up, because I don't want greatobservatories.org or the new Great Observatories movement to be seen as trying to tell the Decadal what to do. The Decadal is populated by a bunch of stone-cold pros who are just the phenomenally brilliant people who will do right by our community. And I absolutely mean that, even if Lynx is bottom ranked, or even if the idea of a new Great Observatories constellation is shot down, or even if they recommend, you know, let's take the decade off and do some tech dev to enable something really big for 2030. They will make the right decision for our community. I want to thank them all genuinely from the bottom of my heart for their efforts, because it's in many ways a thankless but incredibly important job. Yeah, thank you to all the members of the community, but also thank you to every single human being who put so much blood, sweat, and tears into these four exquisitely beautiful final reports, which you can read on greatobservatories.org. And let me just leave you with this. Flagships die 100 deaths. The Chandra X-ray Observatory, which I work on flight operations for, one of the greatest scientific missions in all of history, has died 100 deaths, right? It was canceled in the 1988 president's request, Reagan's budget, totally zeroed it out. We had one chance to save the mission. That came down to a meeting between the NASA administrator and Ronald Reagan. It never ended up going to Reagan himself. During a five-minute conversation between then NASA administrator James Fletcher and James Baker, yes, that James Baker, Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, the NASA administrator said, look, we shouldn't cancel what was then called AXAF, Chandra's sort of code name prior to launch. We can't cancel AXAF. Who will lead the world in X-ray astrophysics? And, you know, that was appealing to the very Cold War nature of the time. And with literally less than a minute of thought, Baker said, yeah, okay, all right, we'll just add it back in. Flagships die 100 deaths. If one or all of us don't make it past this decadal, we'll be back again, because these dreams don't die, right? Sometimes you got to plant trees whose shade you're never going to sit in, or whose shade you're never going to see for a long time, right? You need to invest in distant horizons. These are complex projects. These are scientific pursuits that aren't going to go away. This is not just momentary fashion. Are we alone in the universe? How does our universe work? These are persistent questions that will continue to lie before us. And so I have no doubt that all four of us in some way will see the sky one day. And I just hope that I get to see it, because what a new epic of discovery that would be.
Grant, I hope that all four of these teams, including your own with the Lynx X-ray Observatory, recognize that they have in you a very fine spokesperson. You have joined the passionate spokesperson Hall of Fame here on Planetary Radio. And I think that should guarantee you a return visit before too long. Best of success in realizing these dreams that you share with these four magnificent teams for these four magnificent instruments. And I guess we will know in a matter of weeks. Thank you so much for coming here on Planetary Radio to share the dreams with us.
Really fun to be here, Matt. Thanks so much.
Astrophysicist and leader of the new Great Observatories Coalition, Grant Tremblay. What's up? And Bruce Betts in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, I'm Kate from the Planetary Society. For all its troubles, 2020 has still seen some terrific space accomplishments. We asked our members and supporters to vote for their 2020 favorites. You can see the results at planetary.org/best of 2020. We're talking about the best solar system image, the most exciting moment in planetary science, and much more. That's planetary.org/best of 2020. Happy holidays from the Planetary Society.
Bill Nye, the planetary guy here. The threat of a deadly asteroid impact is real. The answer to avoiding it? Science. And you. It's the only large-scale natural disaster that could one day be prevented. The Society is getting ready to award its next round of Shoemaker Near-Earth Object Grants to talented astronomers around the world. You can learn more about this opportunity and our other work at planetary.org/neo. We're just trying to save the world.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Here is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Dr. Bruce Betts, and he has been evaluating STEP grant proposals as we hit the deadline for that brand new grant program for the Planetary Society. Glad to hear it's moving along. What's moving up there in the night sky?
Ooh, nice segue.
Yeah.
In the evening sky, we've got Venus and Mercury looking quite spectacular, but you'll need a clear view to the western horizon. And you want to look as soon after sunset as possible, just as it starts to darken. And Venus is super bright, as always, and Mercury is a bright star, but nothing compared to Venus. So it'll be a cool sight. Venus much brighter. Mars still up in the evening southwest, looking like a kind of mostly brightish reddish star. And in the pre-dawn, we've got Jupiter and Saturn. Jupiter much brighter, Saturn yellowish up in the east to southeast in the pre-dawn hours. We move on to This Week in Space History. It was 50 years ago that Mariner 9 launched. Mariner 9, the first Mars orbiter, would revolutionize our understanding of the red planet.
Yeah, thank goodness. After getting all the bad views of Mars from its predecessors.
Yeah, it really showed the advantage of an orbiter versus flyby, particularly when your flybys all happen to pass by the heavily cratered region that looks kind of like the moon and not the parts with giant volcanoes and giant canyons and outflow and blah, blah, blah. Cool stuff. We move on to the space fact.
I'm glad you started to cough, because I was about to head down to the bomb shelter.
The International Space Station has a commander at any given time, and the commanders rotate. A Russian national has commanded the station 29 times as of now, U.S. national 28 times, Japanese national, as we'll come back to, commanded twice, and once for Belgian, British, Canadian, German, and Italian nationals.
It's an international space station.
It is an international space station. Now, when did you command, Matt? And was that under your Martian citizenship?
It only lasted 3 days because they pretty quickly realized it was just an Alexa device that I was talking through. That I, you know, stuffed into a jumpsuit. And
God. Well, there's an image that's weird. So let's move on to the trivia contest. I asked you to name all the near-Earth asteroids that spacecraft have touched. How'd we do, Matt?
Some people missed the first one because I guess it was so long ago. And as you've pointed out many times on this show, wasn't intended to touch the asteroid, but did. Here's the answer from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild in Kansas. Eros started off the visits roughly 20 years ago. Also stopped and saw Ryugu, who shot it like a Wild West show. Itokawa got a touchdown from the Hayabusa craft. Bennu is the fourth of them, and of the four, it is the last. Correct, right? We got four?
Correct. Nicely done, nicely phrased.
The first one, Eros, that one that happened so long ago that a lot of people missed, right? That was what spacecraft?
The Near Shoemaker spacecraft, near-Earth asteroid rendezvous. And it was designed as an orbiter, and indeed did orbit the asteroid Eros. But at the end of mission, as they were running out of fuel, they thought, hey, let's see if we can set our orbiter down on the asteroid. Gave them better data on particularly Fields experiments that require being up close and personal. And indeed, they succeeded, and the spacecraft survived after landing.
Way ahead of its time. Here's our winner. I was surprised. It's John Barilli. He's been listening for ages, listening and supporting Planetary Radio. He's a first-time winner, and he got all four of them right. Eros, visited by Near Shoemaker, 2001. Itokawa, visited by Hayabusa 1 in 2005. Bennu, OSIRIS-REx, 2020. And, of course, Ryugu, which was reached by Hayabusa 2 in 2019. Congratulations, John.
Yay!
It's about time. We are going to send you a Planetary Society kick asteroid rubber asteroid. And what could be more appropriate?
Nothing.
We're ready to move on.
Back to space station commanders. On April 27, 2021, Akihiko Hoshide assumed command of the ISS, becoming the second Japanese astronaut to command the station. Who was the first? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You know how this works. You've got until Wednesday, June 2nd at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. And I wish you luck because somebody's going to get another Planetary Radio t-shirt. And they're cool. I was wearing the first generation shirt earlier today. This is the third and a half. Anyway, the current shirt is easily the best. And Bruce is wearing the first generation shirt as well. What a nice coincidence.
Yay.
Yeah, I got a special place in my heart for that first one. So
nostalgia.
We're done. Get us out of here.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about the longest book you ever pretended to read. Thank you. And good night.
Oh, there were several in high school, especially. I'm really sorry, Mr. Tobin, AP English. but thank you so much, Cliff's Notes.
Oh, I love Uncle Cliff's.
That's Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who would never have considered not reading the assigned book back in high school or any other time, because he joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who want to see far beyond the limits of their eyes. It will all become clear at planetary.org/join. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.